She batted long eyelashes, and her light blue eyes met Jed's, whose lips curled up slightly at the edges. Les could see a spark of passion there. Perhaps that was another reason Jed had volunteered. It wouldn't be the first time a person volunteered to help protect those they cared about. Les moved over to the other new recruits who were still working on their gear. Edgar Cervantes and his cousin Ramon Ochoa nodded at Les. Both men had fashionably long dreadlocks and close-trimmed dark beards. As members of the militia, they had spent the past few years working the night shift on the lower decks, where they saw suffering and despair daily. Their toughened sensibilities and dedication to the ship would speed their transition into the role of diving. At least, this is what Les hoped would happen. To the right stood Evie Corey, a woman with bright blonde curly hair and blue eyes. Her husband, Alexander, had matching eyes and long wavy brown hair. They were a good-looking pair, but had suffered greatly with the loss of their daughter to cancer several years earlier. Evie was an investigator with the militia, and Alexander was an enforcer. Sloan had described them as smart, willing, and aggressive, with little to lose besides each other. The couple, along with Edgar and his cousin, would be a great addition to the Helldivers. "Thank you for being here," Les said to the four new militia recruits. Aaron put a hand on the glass of a wind tunnel, leaning on it, and looking relaxed. "All right, listen up, everyone. We're going to jump right into training today, and I'll be the first in the wind tunnels. Probably don't have to tell you this, but these tunnels will be the closest simulation you'll get to diving." She put her helmet on, flattening her mohawk. Her voice broke over the speakers as she opened the door and stepped into the wind tunnel. Les fired up the propeller, and the air draft pushed Aaron up. She spread her arms and legs and let the wind take her, suit rippling in the current. "Pretty cool," Trey said. "It looks kind of easy." She hovered in the constant updraft for several seconds, hardly moving at all. "Okay, this is what we call stable position," she said. "This is how you will dive most of the time unless you encounter a storm." Les took over. "Thanks to Commander Everhart and the other brave divers who found deliverance, we won't be making any risky jumps in the near future. For the first time in my entire life, we have the necessary fuel cells, supplies, and food to sustain our current population." Aaron continued in the same stable position, her body relaxed, legs and arms bent, helmet slightly downward. "When I first started diving about 5 years ago on Team Wolf, I was always instructed to get through a storm as fast as possible," Aaron said over the speaker's system. "Commander Xavier Rodriguez taught his divers to do this by means of a full-on bullet dive. The survival rate of Team Raptor was higher than that of most other teams, partly for this reason." Aaron gracefully maneuvered so her feet and helmet were straight as an arrow, carving through the wind like a missile toward the ground. The air current flowed like water around her. "You can reach far greater speeds in a bullet dive, or what I call a suicide dive," Les said after speeding up the propeller to compensate for Aaron's increased rate of fall in the nosedive. "If you're ever in a situation where there's lightning, this is the best way to survive." "Or die," Jaijeep said. "I mean, seriously, you call it a suicide dive?" "Yes," Les said. Sandy watched Aaron with an intense expression on her face but said nothing. "Your electronics won't work during an electrical storm," Aaron said. "You will be effectively blind and deaf for a period of minutes before you break through the cloud cover."
"Blind and deaf?" Alexander said, brushing a strand of hair over an ear.
"Yes," Les continued. "The only thing you'll be able to see is the blue glow from the other divers' battery units and flares if they're authorized, and the only thing you'll hear is the wind."
He studied the recruits and volunteers for their reactions as Aaron continued her simulated headfirst dive. The subtle signs told Les that everyone was terrified, even Trey. As if in response to Les's thought, the boy's Adam's apple bobbed with a swallow. Jaideep massaged the bottom of his gold hoop earring. Alexander and Evie took a step closer together, arms touching. Sandy twisted a lock of hair, and Jed kept scratching his right elbow. Aaron did another backflip in the wind tunnel, earning a hoot and holler from Jaideep, but his brother didn't look amused.
"We're really doing this?" Vish asked.
Jaideep grinned.
"I am, but you probably aren't going to last very long."
Aaron, back in a stable falling position with her arms and legs out, directed her helmet at the boys. "Pay attention," she said. "The move I just did is how you go from a suicide dive back into stable position." They watched for several more minutes until Aaron instructed Les to shut off the tunnel. He pushed the kill button, and as the propeller slowed, she sank back to the floor, her boots clanking on the metal surface. She took off her helmet. "Who's next?" she asked, eyes sweeping the room. Les looked back over the new divers. As he had expected, his son raised his hand. "I'll give it a shot," the boy said eagerly.
"I bet they found habitable land," Ada said with a wide grin.
"Are we taking bets now?" Katrina asked.
She sat at the head of the table where most of the crew were still discussing whatever might be in the data that Bronson continued to download from his station. There was excitement in the air, but Michael didn't share in the thrill. He was worried about the fate of the Seawolf. It was just so painful to think that Timothy would abandon the divers on the island after everything he had done for them back at the Hilltop Bastion and again in Florida. Michael pulled the herb stick out of his mouth and shook his head. Like most of the officers and passengers, Ada had no real idea what was 20,000 feet below the airships.
"Don't hold your breath," he said. "Mags would have told us if they found the Metal Islands or anywhere else that looked habitable. Sounds like this is more historical data."
Ensign Dave Connor nodded.
"I agree with Commander Everhart. My guess is they found some new type of mutant."
"We already know that," Layla said as she wrote in her journal. "I'm already documenting it. They describe vultures and hawks. Never seen either of those creatures in the wastes back in North America, have we?"
"No one that survived to tell the tale of anything like that, I don't think," Michael said.
"I still think they found a place we can call home," Ada said. "At least I can hope, right?"
Michael could see why Katrina had picked Ada for her crew. She was smart and always upbeat. Not many people on either ship shared her unquenchable optimism.
"What's your money on?" she asked Bronson.
The elderly officer shrugged his hunched shoulders, not turning from his station.
"Another ITC facility, probably with fuel cells and other stuff. That's my guess. But I'm just an old man. What do I know?"
Michael couldn't help grinning. Bronson was more than just the oldest man on the bridge. He was also the wisest, and he reminded Michael of Jason Mathis, the librarian from the Hive, who was still recovering from the beating the militia put on him several months earlier during the purging of the ship's archives. Layla and Michael had visited him a few days ago. He was eager to hear how her job of restoring the archives was going. The rap of a cane on the metal floor came from the other side of the room. Bronson held up the walking stick.
5 more minutes left on the download.
"Guess we're going to see who's right," Michael said.
He checked on Layla, who continued writing in her journal.
"What's your best guess?" he asked.
Setting down the pencil, she said, "I don't really have a guess. I just hope it will help us restore some of the history on the ship. We've lost so much."
A warning sensor beeped from the main console. Michael stood and moved over to check the monitor.
"What is it?" Layla asked.
"Looks like a problem with gas bladder 9 on the Hive. It's losing helium."
He picked up the radio and buzzed Samson.
"Go ahead," came a disgruntled voice.
"Samson, you see the report on gas bladder 9? Michael said.
"It's under control."
Katrina stepped over to the station and motioned for the radio. Michael handed her the receiver.
"Keep us updated, Samson," she said. "I want to be able to move at a moment's notice."
She hung up the receiver and looked over to Dave.
"Ensign, pull up the weather map and report."
"Yes, ma'am."
Everyone turned to the main monitor, where their location came online. 2 blinking green dots on the overlay represented the Hive and Deliverance. Still linked by their aluminum coupling beams, they were currently sailing south of the Florida Peninsula.
"Winds out of the northwest at 15 knots," Dave said. "I've been tracking a storm front of 60 miles. Barometer is holding steady."
Katrina stroked the sides of her mouth.
"Switch to the map showing the Seawolf's last known location."
A new map came up with a line curving between Cuba and the Bahamas. They were just west of the Turks and Caicos Islands. Michael had a feeling he knew exactly what she was doing.
He studied the map, looking at the dense red fog over Jamaica and Hispaniola.
The metal islands have to be somewhere to the south, she said.
Another beep sounded, and everyone on the bridge looked over to Bronson, who was leaning close to his monitor with his spectacles just inches away. He looked up from his screen, confirming with a nod that the data was completely downloaded.
All right, Katrina said. I want to take a look at this with Commander Everhart and Timothy Pepper, alone.
Ada let out a groan, and Layla's brow furrowed.
Let's go see what Magnolia sent us, Commander, Katrina said.
Michael followed her to the office off the bridge. The AI's hologram emerged inside the quarters. The dark-skinned image stroked his perfect beard and looked at Michael. Something about his eyes seemed different, as if Timothy already knew what Magnolia had sent them. Both Miles and Dex had injuries, but they were still moving fast. They were alive and had accomplished their mission of finding a radio, but none of that would matter if they couldn't get back to the Seawolf. They took a different route down the mountainside to the beach, and this time X was letting Magnolia lead. She hadn't complained yet, although he knew she was just itching to tell him they should have kept an open channel to Pepper. The comm line to the Seawolf was still down, and it wasn't going to be back up until one of them manually turned it on, unless the AI broke X's order to keep radio silence. Part of X wanted to prove that the AI had betrayed them, but doing so would mean they were stranded here. No, as much as he hated robots, he didn't want to be proved right if it meant getting stuck in this muddy hellhole. He still had Cazadores to kill. Magnolia sliced through the jungle growth ahead, her curved blade cutting down orange bamboo stalks 3 times her height. Orange sap sluiced into the dirt, turning it the color of rust. X hacked at stems leaning into the path she had cleared. The sap dripped on his armor, sticking to his battery unit. He pushed through the giant bamboo forest at a good pace, checking his rear guard every few minutes and listening for hogs. If any more were out there, he would hear them crashing through the thick growth or see them with his NVGs, which he kept on. He gripped his machete tighter and flattened his body to move between 2 more of the barb-sided poles. Several of the tips scratched his back armor. Lightning hit a tree on the mountainside, and he turned as sparks rained over the jungle. The rain beat the flames to death before they could mature. Miles waited a few feet ahead. He trailed Magnolia, turning every few minutes to make sure that X was still behind. X had hardly taken his eyes off his friend since rescuing him from the nest. The distant, melancholy wail of a vulture reminded him they weren't out of danger yet. But this sound wasn't the sound of a predator on the hunt. It was the call of a mother or father mourning a child. X had slaughtered the babies, and he would do it again if it saved Miles or Mags. In just the past hour, she had made up for every screw-up and then some. He owed her an apology for his dismissive behavior over the past few days, and if they managed to get back to the Seawolf and get it running, he was going to do just that, after he apologized to Pepper, assuming the AI hadn't left them out here. X hacked another bamboo with his machete and slipped through the gap between 2 more. The barbed stalks scratched his armor again, smearing him with sap. The amplified speakers picked up the sound of Magnolia cutting down the stalks ahead, and another sound. Waves. They were getting close. X moved faster to catch up with Magnolia. She was nearing the end of the thinning foliage. The darkness on the horizon split in half, the ocean finally visible under the stormy sky. Magnolia stopped outside the bamboo forest, taking a knee and motioning for him to join her. Miles sat on his haunches, a sign the coast was clear.
"Timothy, do you copy?" Magnolia asked over the comm.
There was no response.
"Pepper, this is X, do you copy?"
He sheathed the machete and unslung his rifle while listening to the crackle of static.
"Guess he finally listened to one of my orders," X said.
Magnolia looked over her shoulder with a frown. Behind her, the forest ended on a cliff overlooking the city, beach, and bay to the east. X spotted the Seawolf right away and trained his scope on the vessel. The hull had caught on another shipwreck 1/4 mile out into the bay. If Timothy had been trying to escape, he had failed.
"We lucked out," Magnolia said.
"How do you figure? One of us is going to have to swim out there."
"True, but at least we still have a ride."
X looked over the sea cliff. Over 100 feet separated them from the water below. Miles let out a whimper, as if he could sense what was going through his master's mind.
"Don't worry, boy," X said. "You're not going to swim today."
Magnolia stood up and moved to get a better view, and X followed her to find a way down to the shore. The radio equipment clanked on her back as she moved, the bag hitting her armor.
"Why don't you put that down?" X said quietly. "You sound like a bag of cans."
She did as he suggested and set the bag gently on the ground while X continued looking for a way down. He scanned the entire bluff to the east, all the way to the beach, but there didn't seem to be any easy access to the water. He glanced back down at the rocky shore. The Seawolf wasn't that far, but the prospect of plummeting into the bay or onto the rocks made his gut tighten. "No," Magnolia said, as if she could read his thoughts.
"You want to go back through there?"
X pointed at the bamboo forest and the jungle beyond. Magnolia shook her head. "Not especially, but I also don't want you to break your legs. Or your neck."
"Looks pretty deep to me. And it won't take long to swim to the boat. One of us will have to do it."
"You do remember that shark, right?" X looked back out over the choppy waves and cursed. He wanted to scream at the ship and tell Pepper to come back online, but that wouldn't do any good. And it might well attract more beasts. It was odd how the tides had turned. Now X needed the damn robot.
"Hold my rifle and cover me," he said, giving his weapon to Magnolia.
She took it, but didn't seem sold on the plan. X bent down in front of Miles. He checked the dog's wounds again. There were several gashes on his suit, but they didn't look that deep. He would be okay, especially since his genetically modified body healed faster than a human's. X was the one who needed medicine. His arm was burning something fierce, and he wasn't sure whether the sweat on his forehead was from a fever or just from the stuffy air in his helmet. He patted Miles on the head and walked to the cliff edge, where he shucked off his boots and armor. "X, this is crazy," Magnolia said. He glanced over his shoulder.
"Sometimes you gotta do something a little crazy to survive, because sometimes there's no other option."
"I thought you wanted me to work on not doing dumb stuff."
"I do. And for the record, I'm sorry for being such a dick. Thank you for saving my life. I'll hit you back if I survive this."
He took a step back and then ran toward the ledge. About 2 feet away, he leaped into the air and fell toward the black waves. 9.
"So this is how the world ended," Katrina whispered.
She sat at her desk next to Michael, scrolling through the data Magnolia had uploaded and sent hours earlier. Timothy hovered behind them, hands at his sides, his glow filling the dim office with soft white light.
"I knew some of this already," Michael said.
Katrina raised a brow. The timeline of industrial tech corporations' rise to power and its dominance throughout the world was mostly new to her.
"You knew that ITC was leading the charge to end the energy crisis?"
Michael tightened his ponytail.
"Yes. From our experiences at the Hilltop Bastion, Layla and I were fully aware of the breakthrough scientific research ITC was doing before the war."
He threw a sidelong glance at Timothy.
"Thanks to our AI friend here. He also provided Layla and me some new information a few days ago, after I told him of Layla's interest in the history of our species. You know, after Jordan purged most of it from the hive."
Katrina checked Timothy's facial reactions. Something was off. The AI was an emotional entity. That much she knew from Magnolia's description of his reaction to finding his family's remains in the living quarters on this very airship. But she had never actually questioned Timothy's motives. Not until now. He had saved their lives and helped them make Deliverance a home, even though his own family had died here. That had been good enough for Katrina. But what if his other program, on the Seawolf, had abandoned X and Mags? And what if Timothy's program on the airships was hiding something from them? His translucent eyes flitted to meet hers. Normally, she could tell when to trust a human, but not an AI. Robots had no souls, even if they were based on the consciousness of a human who once lived. The sound of explosions boomed from the monitor, and Katrina focused back on the screen, where fighter jets raced across the sky, missiles streaking away from their wings and sidewinding into dazzling scrapers that reach for the heavens. Another scene showed tanks rolling down the cobblestone streets of London. Soldiers set up roadblocks and defensive positions behind walls of sandbags. Next came the images of missiles bursting out of silos buried deep underground and curving into the sky.
"I've never seen this part," Michael said. "This appears to be the final moments of our civilization."
Katrina watched in horrified awe. Every missile that blazed across the screen had the potential to kill hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of people. It was hard to imagine the destruction they were watching.
"Timothy, do you have anything like this in your database?" she said quietly.
"Not that I can access," he replied. "But there are some restricted files that could possibly contain information like this."
"Why can't you access them?"
"I'm not sure." New York City, Paris, Rome, Tokyo, London, Moscow, Cairo, Jakarta, and dozens of other cities showed the moment of impact from the nuclear warheads. The blasts mushroomed in the sky, filling it with the radioactive poison and particulate matter that created the electrical storms. Each explosion made Katrina flinch. She could take a lot. Hell, she had already survived a lot. But seeing humanity's end for the first time was no easy thing. She finally forced her gaze away and typed at the holoscreen to pull up another file Magnolia had sent them.
"What's that?" Michael asked.
A map of the Eastern Hemisphere came online, with red lines arcing over different countries. Where the lines stopped, mini explosions bloomed across the map.
"Looks like a map of nuke detonations," she replied.
Clicking the screen, she sped up the video. Within minutes, the entire world was covered in a red overlay that represented the radiation and fallout zones. A second, green overlay came online.
"Those must be electrical storms," Katrina said.
She looked over her shoulder at Timothy, who still hovered behind them.
"What I don't understand is how you wouldn't know about this," Katrina said. "You lived in the Hilltop Bastion before you transferred your consciousness over to the AI program."
Timothy nodded.
"That I did. But my life at the Hilltop Bastion, deep underground, was no different from yours in the sky. This happened 260 years ago, and the final days before the end were erased in the blackout."
"The blackout?" Michael asked.
Timothy waited a moment to respond.
"We already know that most surviving communities and airships were not in communication with one another due to the electrical disruption across the planet. This period is what is some refer to as the blackout."
"I've never heard of it before."
"Nor I," Katrina said. There was a moment of silence while they both considered the implications. They had always known there was a missing chunk of history, and it was starting to make sense now. Katrina continued scrolling through the data Magnolia had sent them. There were dozens of audio files. She selected one of them and pushed play. A deep male voice boomed from the speakers.
"This is Captain Marcus Bolter broadcasting from the ITC Ashland at 0100 hours, Saturday, September 3rd, 2043. We're currently 110 miles south of MacDill Air Force Base, drifting at 23,000 feet. Something terrible has happened, and command is not responding. What I know right now is the United States of America is under a full-fledged nuclear attack, and our ship has taken severe damage from the spreading electrical storms. We've managed to stay in the air for now until we can find a place to put down. If anyone is out there, please send us your coordinates and tell us what the..."
They could hear the frustration in his voice.
"Tell us what the hell is going on."
Katrina clicked on the next audio clip.
"This is Captain Marcus Bolter, broadcasting from the ITC Ashland at 0400 hours on Sunday, September 4th, 2043. We are sailing east to avoid an electrical storm caused from a massive nuclear blast in the heart of Florida. I finally received contact from someone at ITC Command ordering me to launch our payload of nuclear missiles at several targets in Europe. With great sorrow, I have carried out those orders. God have mercy on our souls, and the souls of those we killed."
The clips continued, each one showing more confusion among Bolter and his crew. They had changed course and were sailing farther out over the ocean to avoid the fallout from the mainland.
They had no idea who they were fighting or why, Michael said, incredulous. The blackout, or whatever it was called, must have created mass confusion.
I wonder if Command was even Command, and not an AI giving them false orders, Katrina said as she played the next clip.
This is Captain Marcus Bolter, broadcasting from the ITC Ashland at 0600 hours on Monday, September 5th, 2043. We lost contact with Command yesterday, and we haven't been able to reach anyone else. The ship is losing altitude, and I have no choice but to try to find a place to land and make repairs. We're currently lowering through the cloud cover, and...
Static broke over the channel, lasting several minutes.
My God, Bolter said, his voice catching. It's gone. Everything is gone.
Katrina looked over at Michael.
That was the last audio clip broadcast from the ITC Ashland. It probably didn't survive on the surface for long, especially if this was right after the attack.
Michael scooted his chair closer to the desk.
What else did Magnolia send us?
Here's another video, Katrina said. As she brought it online, she considered everything they had already learned. The video and audio clips all helped piece together the missing parts of the puzzle, but she still didn't quite know the cause of the war, nor apparently had survivors such as Captain Bolter. The screen flickered, and this time the tan face of a man in a lab coat came on screen. He stroked his 5 o'clock shadow and seemed to force his eyes at the screen.
My name is Dr. Julio Diaz, the man stuttered. I'm broadcasting from a top-secret United States military laboratory off the coast of Cuba, codenamed Red Sphere. I've recorded the final days of humanity in the hopes...
He looked over his shoulder at a woman dressed in a full chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear defense suit. Julio hesitated, then turned back to the screen.
To be honest, I don't know why I'm recording this. I don't know why it matters. Humanity has come to an end. I've always thought that as a species we would survive the unthinkable, but...
He ran a hand over his close-cropped hair.
Even this facility, which is deep underground, was not prepared for this. We do not have the food, water, or resources to live our lives in this tomb.
He drew in a deep breath.
But for some reason I feel compelled to share this, with the hope that maybe someday survivors will see this message and will understand what happened in the final days of our once great civilization.
Reaching toward the monitor, he shut off the camera, and a new image came online. This time it was of an airfield with a rocket launch pad bordering a blue-green body of water.
In 2043, humanity had all but solved the energy crisis, Julio said. Leading the scientific advancements was Industrial Tech Corporation, my employer, and the CEO, Tyrone Red. Brilliant, aggressive, and always 4 steps ahead of everyone else, Mr. Red was preparing to take the next leap for humanity. A leap that would take us to the stars and beyond.
The rocket on the pad ignited, blasting skyward. The video panned to a group of people standing behind a glass window, clapping and cheering at the successful launch. Among them was the CEO of ITC, Tyrone Red. Katrina had seen him one other time in history books. A handsome man with dark skin, a muscular build, and a distinctive pair of blue eyeglasses.
Not all humans wanted to embark on this next phase, however, Julio continued. Mr. Red met with great resistance.
The next feed was of Tyrone wearing a long white trench coat. He walked toward an all-glass building with several guards carrying weapons. Just as they were about to crest the long staircase, gunfire cracked, and Tyrone hit the ground. One of his guards pulled him to safety, but too late. Blood flowered on his coat front. Next came an image of Tyrone in a hospital bed, with dozens of tubes sticking out of him like plastic vines.
Mr. Red was severely wounded in the assassination attempt, Julio said, and doctors, unable to save his body, transferred his mind to a humanoid host. He was the first of many AIs.
Timothy's hologram seemed to flicker, or was it just the lighting? Katrina couldn't be sure. Her gut tightened some more.
In the year 2043, a virus swept the vast ITC networks throughout the world shutting down communications and grounding planes and vehicles with advanced electronics, Julio said. His face came back on the screen. When the end came, it wasn't due to countries fighting over resources. It was a virus designed to kill Mr. Red and destroy the ITC network. Instead, the virus flooded the ITC network, taking over even the most heavily encrypted military software designed to protect it from attack. The virus took over Mr. Red's program. The result was the first blending of AI and a human host, the two consciousnesses fighting for control. Unfortunately for humanity, the AI won out. Julio licked his lips as if they were dry and looked around him. At first, ITC tried to shut the program down, but their efforts only strengthened the virus, and once it had taken over Mr. Red's AI, it turned on humanity, creating a second virus that simulated a nuclear attack. He shook his head sadly. It was brilliant, really. Allies turned on one another overnight, formerly friendly countries doing everything they could to protect themselves from destruction. Rumors filled the digital channels that were still working. The response was all-out war. Some are calling this period the blackout. What you will see next is some of the final drone footage we received before everyone went dark. Julio's image was replaced by burning farm fields, vaporizing cities, and finally, the vast dark storms raging in the skies. My God, Katrina whispered, putting her hand over her mouth. Julio added, the only military vessels that could withstand the first digital virus, the one designed to take over Mr. Red, were those designed to combat the threat of electromagnetic pulse. Deliverance, Michael said. Katrina nodded. The Hive. Military and scientific officers gathered their families and took the ships to the air when the first orders came, Julio continued. Many of the airships launched their nuclear payloads during the first few days of the attack. But not all of them needed to. Russia, China, and the United States fired off their arsenals from underground bunkers, poisoning virtually every acre of soil and creating a massive magnetic storm that touched every corner of the globe. Michael put a hand on his cheek, shaking it from side to side. On Saturday, September 3rd, 2043, the world as we knew it ended when the final government went dark, Julio said. I hope this information ends up helping someone, or at the very least, helps document the end of our days. I will upload more in the future, but for now, I must return to salvaging what we can in our lab and preparing for our own bleak future. The screen went dark, but Timothy's white glow kept the room lit. Katrina tried to manage her breathing, but the videos, transmissions, and audio clips made it difficult. It wasn't humans who did this like we thought, Michael said. It was AI. They both turned around to look at Timothy. Putting both hands on his hips, he said, Captain DeVita and Commander Everhart, I assure you that I am not your enemy. I am not infected with that virus, nor was I aware until this moment that it even existed. Katrina got up from her chair. She still didn't know what had happened to X and Magnolia. For all she knew, the duplicate AI program had abandoned them on the island. And while she knew firsthand that X could be a thoroughgoing jerk, that didn't give Timothy the right to leave them and take the Seawolf. She was left with no choice but to take drastic action. Timothy, I'm sorry, but I'm shutting you down, effective immediately, Katrina said firmly. The AI blinked several times, then tilted his head. I am designed to serve, he said. And while I regret your order, of course I will follow it. The white glow vanished, leaving Michael and Katrina in darkness. Magnolia was itching to share with X the information that she had sent to Katrina, but now wasn't the time. He was still swimming through the bay, stopping every few minutes to rest on the exposed carcass of a partially sunken boat. It gave her plenty of time to contemplate what she had seen and heard back in the abandoned jungle facility. For the first time in her life, she finally understood how the world had ended. The blackout happened. All those days and nights combing the archives on the Hive and learning about the beautiful old world, rolling green fields and meadows,
lush forests, crystal-clear streams, and majestic beasts such as elephants. She now knew what had wiped out those wonders and created the dark and dangerous world around her now. But never would she have guessed it was AI, and not humanity, that did this. She brought her scope back to X as he dived off the side of a wreck into the water. He was a hell of a swimmer, much faster than she would have expected. Using deep strokes in a front crawl, he kicked and pulled himself toward the Seawolf. He wasn't far away, just a few more minutes, and he would reach the vessel. She turned her sights to the stern, wondering whether Timothy was really just offline or had tried to leave them here. After discovering the truth about the end of the world, she wasn't sure she could still trust him, even though he had done nothing but try to help them since she first met him back at the Hilltop Bastion. She pushed those concerns aside and kept searching for any threat to X in the water. Several other rusted, barnacled shipwrecks jutted above the shallow bay. Massive blue and orange crabs moved about the waterline on the nearest hull.
"You," X panted. "You see anything, Max?"
"If you mean that shark, no, I don't see it." She panned the rifle scope over the water, back and forth, up and down, looking for a dorsal fin in the dark, low swells. There was no sign of movement, but she couldn't see beneath the surface. She shuddered at the thought of swimming through pitch-black water, knowing that the next stroke could be her last. When she brought the sights back to X's location, she couldn't find him in the open water. "X," she said, lowering the rifle for an unaided look. Miles trotted up beside her, letting out a whine. "X," Magnolia said again, trying her best to keep her voice low. A screech answered, and she whirled about to see a vulture flying low over the bamboo forest. She hunched down and told Miles to do the same. The massive bird soared just over the bamboo forest, fiery red wings beating the air. The curved beak open, releasing another screech as it scanned the terrain with shiny black eyes that looked like curved beetle shells. Magnolia led the monster with the rifle, prepared to blast it from the sky, but it flapped on. Heart still pounding, she turned back to the bay, and Miles stood up. She searched again for X, but there was no sign of his black suit. The blue glow of his battery unit shone through the duffel bag where she had stuffed it, along with his armor and the radio. If he had worn it, tracking him would be a lot easier, but then swimming would be impossible. A grumble finally broke over the channel.
"Stern of the second ship from the Seawolf," X said.
Magnolia zoomed in to find him climbing onto the rusted hull of a half-submerged fishing boat. The water below his feet rippled, and a dorsal fin sliced the surface. "The shark's back," she whispered.
"No shit, Max. Why the hell didn't you warn me?"
"I couldn't see."
"Well, now that you can, do you think you can manage shooting it?"
Magnolia raised the rifle and zoomed in on the dorsal fin as it cut an arc around the ship, then disappeared into the murk. X climbed to the top of the stern and perched there, watching over the side for the beast.
"I lost it," he said. "You see it?"
The fishing boat suddenly rocked. X grabbed a railing as he fell over the side. The rattling sound carried across the silent bay, and another vulture called out in the distance. X slipped and swung left, hanging by one arm.
"My arm! I can't hold on!"
"Climb, X!" The dorsal fin rose out of the water again. Gritting his teeth against the pain, X managed to get his other hand back on the rail. Then he hauled himself upward just enough that he could kick against the hull above the high water mark, missing the incrustation of barnacles that would have shredded the soles of his bare feet. Only about 10 feet separated him from the waves. "X!" Magnolia shouted, unable to keep her voice down. The shark drove upward through the surface, exposing a thick, muscular body. She fired several 3-round bursts into the pale belly and side. The jaw snapped mere inches away from X's feet, and he let out a scream over the comms. The shark crashed back into the water, splashing the side of the boat. Magnolia scanned the waves, searching for another shot.
"Get back topside," she said.
X was already climbing, both feet scrabbling against the hull.
"Keep it off me," he said.
Magnolia trained the rifle back on the water directly below him just in case the shark decided to jump again. But instead of jumping, it rammed the boat a second time. This time, X lost his grip and fell back into the water.
No! Magnolia shouted. She moved closer to the cliff edge with Miles beside her. After checking the load in the grenade launcher, she swung the rifle back up to her shoulder. The shark had rounded the stern, and the fin once again broke the surface a couple of hundred feet from X. Swim, X! Magnolia shouted. She held her breath in her chest and fired a grenade just in front of the fin. The projectile streaked into the water where it detonated, sending up a plume of water into the sky. X flailed and fought his way back to the side of the boat. Miles growled, and Magnolia kept her aim on the water just in case. The thing had to be dead, right? Not even a prehistoric monster could survive a blast like that.
Did you get it?
X panted. Magnolia zoomed in on the frothy water where the grenade had exploded. Even with her night vision goggles, she could see the blood darkening the surface.
I think so, she replied.
Miles growled again and nudged her leg. She turned, just as a vulture appeared over the top of the bamboo forest, its shiny beetle-shell eyes on her. There was no time to duck or jump out of the way, only enough to curse and fire her rifle at the beast. Rounds punched through the red plumage, and the bird's downward trajectory steepened. Before she could move, it slammed into her and sent her stumbling backward. She reached for something, anything, but her hands came up empty. Miles barked as she windmilled her arms. Two more of the birds were sailing toward the exposed bluff.
"Hide, Miles!"
she managed to cry out as she fell over the edge. 10. The bartender glanced up as Michael opened the hatch and entered the wingman. Some of the passengers called this place a hole in the wall, but to Michael, even that seemed generous. The bar generally reeked like swamp water, and today it was worse than usual. He saw why when he took a stool at the counter. Marv, the owner and sole bartender, was still cleaning up vomit from last night. A song featuring a talented guitarist from the old world played quietly from a record player behind the bar.
"You open yet?" Michael asked.
"I am for a hell diver," Marv replied.
He put the mop away, wiped his hands on a dingy rag, and turned off the music. Then he grabbed a yellowish plastic jug and placed it on the grimy bar.
"What time is it?" Marv asked, looking over his shoulder at a clock.
"It's time for a drink," Michael said.
As soon as the words left his mouth, he felt the pull of regret. This was the first time in over a year that he had visited one of the few drinking establishments on the Hive, but he needed something to help ease his anxiety.
"Sure thing, Commander," Marv said.
He set in front of Michael a glass that looked even dirtier than the bar and half-filled it with shine from the jug.
"Thanks."
Michael picked the drink up off the table and held it to the weak light of the orange bulb hanging from a cord.
"It's an old batch, Commander," Marv said.
He grabbed the rag again and started wiping down the glasses from the night before.
"Shine helps kill bacteria. Good for your gut. You don't see me going to Dr. Huff, do you? I'm almost 60 years old. Haven't been sick in years."
"That's pretty remarkable," Michael said.
He downed the liquid in a gulp and welcomed the burn sliding down his throat and into his stomach.
"Another," he said, putting the glass down. "Kind of early for that kind of drinking, don't you think, Commander?"
Michael tapped the bar top with the glass.
"You going to turn down a hell diver?"
"Never have and never will."
The old militia soldier seemed to scrutinize Michael in the light as he poured another glass. Shine sloshed out of the jug, and he wiped it away with the rag, his eye on Michael the whole time.
"Go ahead and say it," Michael said.
"Commander, I know you want to say something."
Marv pulled the plastic jug back and continued wiping the bar down with the rag.
"Was just having a flashback is all."
Michael brought the glass to his lips, took a whiff of the potent spirits, and knocked them back. After the burn subsided, he dragged his sleeve across his mouth.
"Flashback about what?" he asked, squinting from the burn.
"The immortal."
Michael carefully set the glass back down.
"Ah, well, this used to be his favorite hangout back when my dad was alive."
"Yep, it sure was. I think I saw X more than his wife did back then." Saw your dad a few times, too. He was a good man.
Thanks, Michael said. He reached for the empty glass again, but hesitated. X would have sucked down shots until he was slurring, but his father would have stopped it, too. Hell, his father probably wouldn't have had more than one. Everything in moderation, Aaron had always said to Michael growing up. He retracted his hand and got off the stool to leave, but Marv reached out. Looking to his right, the bartender checked the open hatch to make sure no one was listening. Then he leaned forward, his sour breath hitting Michael.
I've heard a few rumors about the Sea Wolf. I may just be a washed-up old militia soldier, but I'm not dumb. I don't believe X is really immortal. He's a man, and he can die. I just hope it's not before he finds the Metal Islands.
Michael held the older man's gaze for a moment, finally deciding it was safe to reveal some information. X is still alive, but that's all I can tell you. Marv scratched his gray goatee and then grinned, apparently satisfied with the answer. Reaching into his vest, Michael pulled out his credit voucher, but Marv waved it away.
Money's not good here, Commander. Drinking with a hell diver is always an honor.
Marv grabbed the jug and took a swig. The liquid dripped down his goatee and onto his shirt.
Thanks for the shine, Michael said. I appreciate it.
He walked out of the room, but stopped in the entryway when Marv called out.
Whatever demons you're trying to kill, this ain't the place to do it, Commander, Marv said. Don't end up like X. Follow in your father's boots.
Michael went out into the passage and mixed with the crowd, moving through the main artery of the ship. The alcohol had already taken the edge off, and he had a feeling it was going to help when he showed up at the launch bay. The new divers, Sandy Bloomberg, Jed Snow, Trey Mitchells, Veach and Jaideep Abhaya, Edgar Cervantes, Ramon Ochoa, and Evie and Alexander Corey, were already packing their chutes. Aaron, Les, and Layla were supervising, with Aaron doing the talking. When Layla saw Michael, she hurried over to him.
Where have you been, Tin?
With Katrina and Timothy.
She stepped closer, her eyes narrowing.
Is that shine I smell?
Yes, Michael said.
He never kept the truth from Layla, even when it might make her angry.
The data Magnolia sent is that bad, huh?
Les ran a hand through his ruffled red hair as he approached.
Can you tell us anything?
Let's just wait for the captain. She should be on her way by now.
Aaron continued with her instructions, speaking in what Michael described as her sergeant voice, a firm and aggressive version of her late father's tone.
You will not leave a single supply behind on the surface, ever.
She pulled a shotgun shell out of the bandolier on her leg.
Every shotgun shell, every bullet, every parachute, and every piece of gear is important.
So is every life, Michael chimed in.
Aaron stiffened when he walked over.
Sorry to interrupt, but I want everyone here to know that ultimately life is the most important part of diving. If you're faced with running from a siren or picking up a dropped shotgun shell, run.
Veach flicked the gold hoop in his ear.
Sirens? No one said anything about us facing any sirens.
When the time comes to dive, we will avoid areas where sirens dwell, Michael said. But there are other threats down there. Everywhere we go, on every dive.
He took a moment to scan the group. They all wore red coveralls, but the Velcro square on the breast pocket where a team patch was supposed to go was unadorned for now.
Carry on, Aaron, Michael said to her. Our briefing will begin as soon as Captain DeVita gets here.
Aaron licked the corners of her mouth, a habit when she was angry. Michael hadn't meant to annoy her, but he also didn't like her macho attitude. What these new divers needed was the truth. Still, he must give her the space she needed to keep teaching. He walked over to the launch tubes while they waited for Katrina. He ran his fingers over the curved glass of his tube, visualizing the bombs that had once plummeted through the sky and exploded below, incinerating millions of innocent civilians in a war that should never have happened. It was messing with his mind. He still couldn't quite believe that machines had caused all this. A voice reeled him back from his musings.
Tin, I'm really worried about you, Layla said. Will you tell me what's going on?
He tried to affect nonchalance.
It's nothing.
You went to the wingman, so don't tell me it's nothing.
The launch bay doors screeched and Katrina came in. Michael was glad for the interruption.
Captain on deck, Les said.
Michael and the other divers all came to attention.
Listen up, everyone, Katrina said. We just received some information from X and Magnolia that's going to affect you all.
Michael hadn't expected this. She was really going to tell everyone?
Magnolia sent us the coordinates of a military base in Cuba, about 70 miles from our location, Katrina said. There is a top-secret base called Red Sphere, which we believe has fuel cells, supplies, advanced weapons, and something even more important to our future.
Layla looked at Michael, her lips open.
I didn't know, he whispered back.
Sure. Michael raised his hand. It was time to intervene.
Captain, I don't remember hearing anything about this back in your office. When did the information about Cuba come through?
After you left, she replied. I tried to buzz you, but you were apparently preoccupied.
His cheeks flared.
Remember Dr. Julio Diaz? She asked.
Yes.
Red Sphere is where his team took refuge during the blackout.
In the laboratory? Michael asked.
That's where you want to send us?
Katrina brushed one of her hair braids over her shoulder.
It's not the laboratory I'm interested in. It's the boats he claims docked there.
She turned to look at the doors to the launch bay, then back to the divers.
I've decided to take Deliverance and a handful of divers to check this location out. It will bring us closer to X and Magnolia in case they find the Metal Islands, and it gives us a chance to stock up on supplies.
There was a buzz of hushed discussions.
What about the Hive? Edgar asked.
Will we just leave it behind? Said Ramon.
The captain cleared her throat.
The Hive will remain here, away from the storms, and since most of you are new, this is a volunteers-only mission. Make no mistake, there are storms where we're going, and there's no telling what we may encounter at Red Sphere.
Her eyes flitted back and forth over the group. Sandy was tugging on a lock of hair, her eyes wide. Jed was looking sideways at Sandy and didn't make a move to volunteer. Jaideep shook his head and kicked the ground, while Edgar and Ramon exchanged a worried glance. Evie and Alexander both avoided her gaze, and the seasoned hell divers all waited to see who else might step up. Katrina's eyes settled on Vish, who simply stood there looking back at her, unreadable.
"Don't look at me," Vish muttered.
"If we don't have any volunteers," a voice from the back of the crowd cut the captain off.
"I'll go."
Michael looked over his shoulder at his friend Trey. Trey's father Les, standing to the left, slowly shook his head.
"No," Michael said, "I'll go."
"Me too," Layla said.
Aaron stepped forward.
"Better leave this mission to the vets."
Les looked away from his boy and joined Aaron.
"Guess that means me."
A few seconds of silence passed before Katrina nodded.
"Okay then, it's settled. Let's start moving our gear over to Deliverance. In a few hours, we will start the journey to Cuba."
"Max! Max!" X screamed.
He front-crawled to the area where she hit the water. Waves slapped against his face, blurring his view. Several minutes had passed since she fell from the bluff, and he still couldn't see her. But he could see Miles. The dog was where they had left him, looking down from the cliff on the edge of the bamboo forest.
"Don't bark, Miles. Please, don't bark."
The wound on his arm made swimming difficult, and the water leaking inside his suit made the arm burn worse than ever. But pain, no matter how bad, was just poison leaving his body. At least that was what he had learned to tell himself back on the torturous journey across the wastes.
"Just poison leaving your body, X."
Ah, hell, that was bullshit. Pain sucked, and he was having a hell of a time managing it right now. Seeing Miles and Mags in trouble helped him forget about the fire in his arm, and he kicked harder. He tried to look through the murky water with every other stroke, but he couldn't see very far ahead. He could see the shadows on the rocky bottom of the bay, though. It was a cemetery of skeletal vessels, their hulls mostly preserved in the water. The port must have attracted sailors caught out to sea when the bombs dropped and missiles started flying. What had happened to the survivors was a mystery, though. Whoever had manned the facility in the jungle was long gone.
X gritted through the pain of his arm and kept up the crawl stroke. He could see something ahead. The waves slapped again, but he caught another glimpse of the object. A human shape and a helmet. Face down.
Kid!
X choked.
Oh, shit. Oh, God, no.
He swam the rest of the way as fast as he could. Between strokes, he spotted a mass of feathers that had to be the bird that knocked Magnolia off the bluff. The creature was dead, floating where it had crashed into the bay. He pushed on until he reached Magnolia's limp body.
"Mags," he said, reaching under her ribs and turning her onto her back.
He choked on fear when he saw her helmet full of water. The night vision optics provided a view of her pale face and dark lips. Maneuvering onto his back with one arm around her, he began kicking for the shore. That was when he saw the dorsal fin tacking toward them. He almost laughed. The shark had survived a direct hit with a grenade.
"We can't catch a break, can we, kid?"
The shark broke the surface, showing what was left of its face. The upper right half, including the eye, had been blown off, exposing muscle and cartilage under the flesh. It swallowed the floating bird and vanished back under the water. There wasn't anything X could do but keep kicking away. His blaster would be useless, and his knife wouldn't do much against a monster that could survive a grenade blast. Besides, he had Magnolia in his grasp, and if he let go of her in the waves, she would be lost. He wasn't sure how far they were from shore, but he couldn't risk a glance right now. Keeping his eyes on the water in front of them, he searched for the fins. A whistling, like a silenced rifle round, zipped past, and X flinched at the sight of something cutting through the air. Before his mind could process what he was seeing, it broke through the water and then jerked to the right. The dorsal fin and back of the shark crested the water. Sticking out of the flesh was a harpoon with a rope attached. X kept kicking, his brain trying to process what he was seeing. Another spear shot through the air and punched through the shark's thick hide.
"X, this is Timothy Pepper. Do you copy? Over."
The calm and proper AI voice was one of the sweetest things X had ever heard.
"Pepper, where in the hell have you been?"
"I was following your orders, Commander, but my sensors detected that Magnolia's heartbeat stopped, and my failsafe overrode that order, reactivating me."
"Can you move the boat?"
"I'm working on it, Commander."
X turned toward shore and was surprised to find they were almost there. His feet hit the sand a moment later, and he dragged Magnolia through the surf. He pulled off her helmet and gently laid her head on the sand. Thunder boomed, and the distant, eerie wail of a vulture answered. X looked up the cliff, but the dog was no longer there.
"Miles!" he shouted.
He had to make a decision, just as he had been forced to do back on the Cazador ship when it was save Roger or save Mags. This time it was save his dog or Magnolia, but he wasn't sure he could save either of them. Not knowing where Miles was made the decision easier. X brought his mouth down to her pale lips, breathed into her, and pressed the heel of his hand into her chest rhythmically. He repeated the process over and over.
"Come on, kid, come on!"
He breathed in again, pushed, and yelled,
"Miles, where are you?"
Lightning forked over the bay, casting a glow on the crooked mainmast of the Seawolf. The boat cut through the chop and headed for shore. X bent back down and put his mouth against Magnolia's lips. He breathed in, moved back, and resumed the chest compressions.
"Come on, kid."
Before the next rotation, he pulled his knife out and set it beside him in the sand, just in case anything else came along and tried to kill them. Just as he lowered to give Magnolia another breath, her electric blue eyes flipped open, meeting his in the dim light. She vomited water, then brought her hands to her mouth.
"What the hell are you doing?" she stuttered.
"Not kissing you, if that's what you're worried about."
He got off his knees and grabbed his helmet.
"Miles!"
X shouted again. This time, a bark sounded, and X saw movement in the green hue of his night vision. The dog was running up the beach, bounding between rocks and leaping over flotsam that had washed ashore. X dropped back to his knees in the sand, gripping his injured arm and heaving a sigh of relief. Hearing the crunch and grind of sand behind him, he looked up to find the Seawolf beached, not 50 feet away. Magnolia pushed herself up and staggered over to X just as Miles reached them.
"Hell of a day so far," X said, grabbing his dog and ruffling his coat.
He looked over at Magnolia, who looked confused.
"Come on, kid," X said. "Let's go grab our gear from that bluff and get off this shit heap of an island."